Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack. Welcome back to Top Shelf, everybody. I am your host, Carol Ann Tack, and as always, I cannot thank you enough for spending your time with me today on your Top Shelf podcast. This is the Top Shelf podcast for Merrick Library. Well, how exciting for all of us, because today's guest is debut author Angie Kim, and even though she's been writing in some form for a long time, this debut novel is really extraordinary, and I cannot wait to talk about it with her. And before I get to any of that, I just want to give a little bio for today's guest. So Angie Kim moved as a preteen from Seoul, South Korea, to the suburbs of Baltimore. She attended Stanford University and Harvard Law School, where she was an editor of the Harvard Law Review and then practiced as a trial lawyer at Williams & Connolly. Her stories have won the Glamour Essay Contest, and we'll get to that because that is some contest, and the Wabash Prize in Fiction, and she's appeared in numerous publications, most recently Vogue magazine, but she's also appeared in the New York Times, Salon, Slate, the Southern Review, Sycamore Review, the Asian American Literary Review, and Pank. Now that is a lot of stuff and a lot of beautiful writing, which we will get to. Guys, you are really in for a treat. Having said all of that, I must welcome wholeheartedly my guest, Angie Kim. Welcome to Top Shelf, Angie.
Thank you so much, Carol Ann. I think I told you before that I'm a lover of podcasts, so I'm really excited for this. And I also love libraries, so this is just the perfect first podcast interview for me.
Hooray. I'm thrilled that you said yes to the dress, as they say. I really am thrilled. Your debut novel, I want to get right to this, is called Miracle Creek. And this book is taking the library world by storm. And by library world, I mean all of the librarians across the country that are avid readers. We're on Twitter talking about it. We're on Facebook talking about it. And it's just wonderful. I can't wait for readers to get a hold of it. It will be published on, I believe, April 16th. You'll correct me if that's wrong.
No, that's correct.
But
yeah.
Listeners, April 16th. I will post a link to the book where you can place your hold, and I will also place a link to Angie's website so you can actually purchase the book from through the website, and you can get it, put it on hold at the Merrick Library. Now, I'm mentioning the library world because in January, Angie, you were a panelist on the Library Reads debut author panel at the American Library Association Midwinter Conference. I cannot even imagine, what was that experience like for you?
It was so amazing because I am such a lover of libraries. I was an immigrant as a preteen in middle school in Baltimore, where I didn't speak English. I didn't understand English. And there was a lot of bullying that went on during middle school years and things like that. And my local library was my haven. And the librarians were so kind and so helpful and you know, helping me to translate things, helping me to look up things, you know, using hand signals and the Korean English dictionary to try to understand what I was trying to communicate with them, and so kind. So I will forever be indebted to librarians in my hometown, certainly, of Lutherville and Towson. But also just everywhere. And so for me, it was a real special treat. I got to meet many, many librarians throughout that whole weekend and talk about my book, Miracle Creek, talk about other books that we were all excited about, as well as our background. So it was just an amazing treat for me.
Yeah, and it's such a warm, embracing crowd. I mean, I think, obviously, I'm completely biased, but I really, you know, librarians were just an amazing group of people. And I'm so happy for you that you were able to sit on this panel. It must have been an incredible experience. I mean, it sounds like it was. So when I started reading The Galley, the first line, you know, you get boxes, and thank you to all of the publicists who send us these books and the publishing houses. We get these big, huge boxes of book mail, which is unbelievable. It's like hitting the lottery every single day. And this book was kind of right on the top of the package with all these books.
Oh.
The first thing I saw was the cover. And I thought,
wow, look at this beautiful piece of art. So I open to the first page and I read the sort of the intro pieces. And then I read the first line, which is from the incident, the first chapter, where you say, my husband asked me to lie. Not a big lie. He didn't even consider it a lie, and neither did I at first. Well, my kids and husband did not see me for the rest of the weekend after I read that. They were like, where's mom? Oh, she's reading Miracle Creek.
Oh, that's so kind.
Yeah. So, and then I would say about a quarter of the way through, I started on Twitter emailing and saying to other library friends, are you reading this book? What's going on? And everyone's like, yeah, we're reading it. So it became quite a thing. It starts off with such a suspenseful feel. It has a little bit of, it just reminds me of other books, Little Town Drama. It also has a bit of this family, a lot of this family stuff. So a lot of people are comparing Miracle Creek to Big Little Lies, Everything I Never Told You. And I'm not going to spoil anything, but what can you tell us about Miracle Creek that doesn't give away anything? Because this book is action-packed.
Sure. And before I summarize my book, I just have to say thank you for mentioning my book along those books, which I love and, you know, are just, and I love those authors. I love their other books. And so just to be compared in and mentioned in the same sentence as those authors and those books is such a huge honor for me. So thank you for
that.
Oh, you're
welcome. Well, you did all the heavy lifting.
So Miracle Creek is a literary courtroom drama about a Korean immigrant family and a young single mother who's on trial for murdering her 8-year-old autistic son. So at the center of my novel are Young and Park Yu, the Yu family, who came to America to make a better life for themselves and for their daughter, Mary, and who is, like I was when I came to America, was a preteen. And now, at the time of the novel, is a teenager. They settle in a small Virginia town called Miracle Creek and operate what they call Miracle Submarine, which is a pressurized chamber for hyperbaric oxygen therapy, or HBOT. And it's a real thing. It's an experimental treatment for conditions like autism and cerebral palsy and infertility. And all goes well until one day, with six people sealed inside this group chamber, someone sets a fire by the oxygen tank, which holds pure oxygen, which explodes, killing two people and injuring others. So in one sense, Miracle Creek is a legal thriller. The readers become jurors as the murder trial uncovers secrets from that night to find out who set the fire, how, and why. Was it the mother of one of the patients who's the actual defendant, who's the defendant in the murder trial? Or was it Young and Park themselves hoping to cash in on the insurance payment and help to send Mary to college? But much more than the mystery, I hope, we explore the lives of these characters, the immigrants and the patients and the mothers who were in Miracle Submarine that night. And we see the sacrifices and the desperation even that come with special needs parenting and immigrant life in rural America. So that's Miracle Creek in a nutshell.
In a nutshell. And yes, it is that legal thriller. It is all of those things. And I love that what you give the reader is a compelling court case with narratives from all of the different players involved. And the slow reveal of each character and the secrets and the things that they're not saying and their own backstories that help inform the decisions that they are about to make or that they have already made in the past. So you get these behind-the-scenes looks at their motivations, again, the slow reveal, but the narrative is so swift that I was just swept along with the current, and even though this is a creek, it was rapids, I have to tell you.
That's great.
And I feel a large part of the compelling story with the young family, it appears that it has some very personal aspects of it. You mentioned earlier when we talked about your bio that you moved as a preteen from Seoul to the United States, and it seems that Mary's mom and the way she works at the beginning of this of the book, where she works, this, mm-hmm. the location that she has to work, that seems very personal to me. You wrote it, and I'm wondering if that's something that's been part of your experience growing up.
Yeah, and, you know, as you've said, this is my first novel, and people say that, you know, writers usually put a lot of themselves into their first novels, and I think that's definitely the case here. So Miracle Creek is a combination of three different strands of my life that sort of came together and fused and braided into this narrative. And the first strand is the immigrant strand, you know, so we did come. It's less the Miracle submarine, the HBOT operations center that's taken from my life with my parents anyway. And because my parents ran a grocery store in Baltimore, which is in flashbacks, you see that past of the Hughes, that before they operated this Miracle submarine in rural Virginia, they were in Baltimore, in a very dangerous part of Baltimore, in a grocery store. And we see what it was like for them as immigrants coming over to a new land where they know no one, where they don't speak the language, where they don't know the culture, they don't know what to wear, you know, including Mary, who's, you know, middle school at that point. And we see the loneliness and the isolation and just the desperation of wanting to make new connections with people in and yet feeling like a foreigner. So we see all of that. And I think that's definitely taken almost directly from my own experience and from the experience that I think my parents had as well. So that's one strand of it. And then the other two strands are the HBOT world itself. I was actually the mother of an HBOT Miracle submarine patient, if you will. So one of my kids went through the experimental therapies that we talk about in the novel. And so I did experience that personally. And then the third strand is that I was a trial lawyer. And so I took some of those experiences and I sort of tried to braid them into a whole that made this novel into something that is, you know, a fun and exciting, hopefully page-turning type of courtroom thriller, but at the same time really takes a deep dive into what it's like to be, you know, a parent who's undergoing these types of medical issues with their kids, as well as an immigrant.
Yeah, and I think when I mentioned earlier about your website, it is a terrific website, by the way. And I will, provide a link for everybody. I mean, it's chock full of fabulous material, including, listeners, a Miracle Creek Reader's Guide for book discussions, which is invaluable. But the website also features a lot of your essays, and one piece in particular is from the February 2019 issue of Vogue, which you just talked about, and you get very personal with Vogue about your experience there with your son. What made you decide to sort of submit this essay? Was it something that, did it come out of the book itself, or was it like you sort of feel the need to instruct people and help people along here?
Yeah, and so the Vogue essay really came out of my desire to sort of clarify. People were talking about, oh, she actually has personal experience doing this HBOT therapy, the hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And I felt the need to sort of tell people what that experience was like, because it is a huge part of the novel, and it's something that I am going to be talking about. And I've had sort of a policy with my husband and with my family of not really talking about the kids, especially their medical issues, because, you know, there's privacy issues involved, and, you know, you don't know what the ramifications are going to be. But this is something that we did, and there's so much of it that I put into the novel that we wanted to. We talked about it as a family, and I said, you know, I'd like to explain how we came to do this. And luckily, all of the medical issues that my kids had, and there were plenty for all three of them that were wildly different, but all three of them are fine now.
Thank goodness.
And so we thought, you know, they're now getting to the age where we can actually talk about this and talk about whether we want to start talking about our experiences. And the kids are at an age where they can start to sort of say, yeah, I think that's a part of my story that I'm comfortable with, you know, you guys talking about in public and things like that. So the story is that one of my kids, and I have three sons, and one of my kids was born deaf in one ear. And the same kid, when he was a toddler, we found out had celiac disease and developed really awful ulcerative colitis. Nothing worked, and he was in pain, not gaining weight, and we heard about this weird experimental hyperbaric oxygen therapy from a neighbor. And we went to visit, and my son said, look, it's a submarine. And we've been watching the Beatles' Yellow Submarine. Oh. It looked like a submarine. It had, you know, the portholes and the side and the hatch. So it's a group chamber, and four patients go in, mostly kids with cerebral palsy, autism, Lyme disease, things like that. And so we decided to try it, and the dives are these hour-long sessions, and we did 40 that summer, which is sort of the standard protocol for ulcerative colitis. And what's amazing is that this chamber, it's like a crucible where you're sealed in with mostly the same families day after day, an hour at a time, and there's nothing to do because there's the risk of fire with the oxygen. So they wouldn't let us take anything inside. So no phones, no magazines, no electronics, toys, nothing. And so they set up DVD screens outside through the portholes so that the kids could see the DVDs, like, you know, Barney and Sesame Street and things like that. But for us moms and a few dads in there, it was a time for us to just connect with each other. And because it's a darkened chamber, it has this confessional feel. And so we grew very intimate with each other, telling our life stories, comparing and contrasting our various treatment protocols. And
well, at that point, you're almost closer than family, right? You're sitting there with these people, all of these other families, and you become this tight-knit group. I mean, you have...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, and not only that, but we had to deal with emergencies that came up, you know, everything from, you know, the kids would go, oh, I have to go to the bathroom. Well, you know, so what do you do at that point?
Right.
And, you know, so we learned to keep, you know, pee jars, we call them, you know, and things like that. And we had to deal with, you know, kids who did, you know, had stims like head banging or fecal smearing and things like that, that came up, and we had to sort of band together. So we became this very intimate community for a very short period of time. So it had this feel where you just thought, what if something went wrong in here? You know, you're sealed in, you can't get out, at least for a little bit, because they have to depressurize and open, and it's not just like opening a door. And so that led itself to so many fictional situations that I could think of that I thought would be really conflict-ridden and suspenseful. And that's what one of the reasons why I ended up choosing it for the novel. And so I wrote about that experience for Vogue, and the editors at Vogue were so amazing and really worked with me to be able to tell the story in hopefully a meaningful way that's also emotionally resonant.
Well, especially since everybody that I know who is a parent, you have however many children, and there is always some sort of a medical issue that needs to be addressed, and it becomes paramount and primary and the only thing in your life until you can make it work and make your child better, because that's what you will do. You will do anything. And I love that that piece came out, because I'm sure, you know, there were other people, other parents, who will absolutely be comforted by reading the struggles of other people. You're not alone in this environment.
Exactly. And you hit the nail on the head as far as the best part of publishing both this book and also the Vogue essay is just the personal emails and messages that I'm getting from the readers who are saying, you know, I'm an early reader and I got an advanced copy, or, you know, they read the article and, you know, they're telling me it's not the same situation. It may be a different medical situation, or it may be a special need, you know, or something like that. But whatever it is, for them to feel like, you know, sometimes they have these moments where just you're overwhelmed and you have maybe some feelings and, you know, fleeting thoughts that you're ashamed of, thinking of back to it later, because we're all human. And to sort of see that in writing, even if it's a fictional character, and feeling like you're not alone, feeling like this is normal, the kinds of things that you're feeling and experiencing. And that's been so gratifying to me.
And I'm writing in a legal capacity, to actually writing fiction. And I mentioned briefly before the glamour contest and all the judges in that contest. I mean, Jesmyn Moore, Jane Smiley, Anne Brashear, Erin Morgenstern, for heaven's sake. Folks, the listeners, you can find that essay, which is tremendously written. It's beautiful. You can find that on Angie's website. But how was that transition to go from writing in a much more formal capacity to, say, novel writing? Was that an easier transition than you thought it would be?
So, you know, I've been writing for so long as, you know, a reporter when I was in college for my, you know, college newspaper, and then as an editor of this legal journal, the Harvard Law Review. And then, you know, I was a lawyer for a long time, and then I was in business, so lots of memos and reports and things like that. So I had always been writing, but I had never done fiction writing before, or even any creative writing. So I'd never done like essays or, you know, memoir type pieces and things like that. And the glamour essay was so fun because it was my first attempt at humor. It was my first humor essay. It's about how I learned English by reading my aunt's Sydney Sheldon novels, in particular, my favorite book called Rage of Angels, which features a litigator. So I think that may be one of the reasons why I became a trial lawyer.
Oh my God. And I don't want to spoil anything that is hysterical. I don't want to spoil anything for the listeners, but I want them to go find it on the website because it is, if it's your first attempt at humor, holy cow, I was laughing out loud, sitting at my desk at work, cracking up. So your book is coming out April 16th. Are you ready for this book tour? It's such an exciting time. Will readers be able to see? I guess you'll be posting your tour dates as you get them on the website.
Yes, definitely. I think I'm right now, this week, we just figured out our schedule for California and Minnesota. And I know that I'll be coming to Chicago and Boston and New York, and also some of the East Coast beaches this summer.
Well, we like that.
So fun. Exactly. And obviously, I'll be doing a lot of events in D.C., which is where and Northern Virginia, which is where I am now, and Baltimore, which is my hometown, just a short drive away. So I'm really, really excited. My husband, I think, is a little bit wary of, you know, the fact that he has to take care of three kids on his own and drive them all around.
Yeah, I was thinking about childcare, actually.
So that's going to be a little iffy, but luckily my parents will be around as well. And luckily, one of my kids is actually driving now. So That's both terrifying and a little bit of a relief.
Yeah, that, I mean, you know, I have a 23-year-old and a 20-year-old, and when they get behind the wheel of the car, it is just not easy, even with their ages.
it's terrifying. It really is, because you just don't know. And you remember, you know, being a teenager yourself, and just a lack of judgment that, you know, you had. And I was such an idiot. I was rebellious. I was just ridiculous. And I just feel like, I have to be understanding because I remember being that way. But boy, is it really, really nerve-wracking as a parent.
It is. I keep my hair colorist employed, that's for sure.
Yes, definitely.
She's very fortunate. So before I let you go, I just wanted to say, you mentioned your parents. Have they read the book?
So they have. My dad apparently read the advanced copy in like 2 days, and he's not a talker. He just doesn't say much, especially not anything emotional. But the fact that he read it so quickly told me that he was really into it and enjoyed it. So that was really sort of enough for me on that. Now, my mom, on the other hand, she didn't read it. She is a huge reader, and she didn't read it for the longest time. And I was just like, what is happening that she's not reading it? And I was getting a little bit, you know, like either I was a little nervous and also just a little bit annoyed that, like, you know, here I've written this book and she's my mother and she's not reading it. But actually, and maybe it was like several months after I gave her the copy, she finally called one night and she said, you know, I just finished it. And she was sobbing.
Oh.
And I'm getting teary eyed just thinking about it. So, but she said that she was just, you know, she said she was so proud. She loved it. She, you know, just was. But I think it took her so long to read it because it was so painful. And she actually started the conversation with me by apologizing for, you know, everything that had happened with, when we first came to America, and my parents had to work really long hours in the downtown store, and so they lived there, and I lived with my aunt and uncle in the suburbs in Lutherville, and she apologized for, you know, abandoning me, which is something that I say in the novel about how Mary felt abandoned, and Young recognizes that. Young, the mother, recognizes that. And, you know, and I said, you know, of course I understand. You know, she didn't do it. She did it for us. She did it for me. So it was actually a great act of self-sacrifice on her part and on my dad's part to do that for me and for my future. But of course, when I was young, I didn't, you know, see it that way. And right. Even though I knew that intellectually, I still didn't. And so I treated my parents, I think, pretty horribly. And I think I was pretty bratty and accused them of, of abandoning me and things like that.
Well, not unlike what Mary does in the book. I mean,
exactly, right. Exactly. And I think seeing that really brought that back. And I told my mom, look, this is fiction. But of course, she could see the sort of emotional truth at the core of these characters in this family. And so I think it was actually really great because in the process of writing this novel, I was able to, you know, go ahead and understand the story sort of from my mom's or slash Young's perspective when we were going through that. So I think that was really good. And we had a really great chat about both the book and sort of the emotions around it. So I'm glad that she got to it, but it was an emotional journey,
And it seems in some way therapeutic for everybody, you know, to sort of get that out there. And I think that's what's so great about the novel is that you get these different perspectives, these different narratives, and you get Young's perspective, especially as a mom and where she's coming from. And it's really, it's just beautifully done. And I can't wait.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really can't wait for readers to get a hold of it. And I can't imagine your mom on book tour, but now maybe she'll make it appear, a little cameo appearance at some point.
All right. Well, she will be at my launch event, which is going to be at Politics and Prose in D.C. So I'm really excited about that.
Okay. Well, hopefully we'll see some pictures on the website.
Definitely.
Angie, I cannot thank you enough for joining me today on Merrick Library's Top Shelf. It's been an absolute pleasure and an honor. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so, so much for having me. This has been so much fun.
Okay.
And such an honor as well. So thank you.
All right, listeners. that was an incredible interview. You can find Angie Kim on her homepage, which is angiekimbooks.com. I'll provide that link on the podcast page for episode 27. Episode 27, I never thought I'd see that. Copies of Angie Kim's Miracle Creek will hit shelves on Tuesday, April 16th. And, of course, I will include a link to place your reserve. Once again, listeners, I thank you for joining us today on Top Shelf at Merrick Library. Remember to follow us on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and wherever you find most podcasts. Don't forget to check out the Merrick Library website at www.merricklibrary.org. Special thanks, as always, to Merrick Library Director Ellen Firer and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and onto the airwaves. Until next time, remember, keep us on your top shelf.